White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy. So get a spot of tea, sit down and relax, because it's time for another show on the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. That is now White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy. It's April the 28th, 2015, and it's Thursday here in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, where the sun is beautiful today and it's warmed up and it's just wonderful. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show. That's where you send your snail mail and all that kind of stuff. And then go up to resist.com and get some education, man, because you're going to need it to survive as time goes by. Well, I was just sitting here wondering what we're going to talk about today, and I got back into my archives here, was looking around, and I come up with a lot of stuff, but it came up with this one, which I didn't quite remember filing away, but it's quite interesting. It's called AdolfTheGreat.com. Now, I don't know about you, but I've smelled a rat in the whole Holocaust thing. Not from the basic way people attack it, that it didn't happen or something like that, or lots of Jews didn't die, but that there was a smokescreen. There's something really smells way behind the story of the Jews in Germany at the time of Adolf Hitler. This article goes into that a little bit. Adolf's Jewish support. Wow, that's a mouthful. Documenting Jewish support for Adolf Hitler, common in his lifetime, yet politically incorrect after the war. Perhaps no subject on earth has been so misrepresented as between Adolf Hitler and the German Jews. On the one side were groups of nationalists and communists who hated Jews and would stop at nothing to vent their hatred against any and all Jews. On the other side were moderate, for the time, Germans who collaborated with Jewish Zionists to reach an amicable settlement which would gradually move Jews to a homeland of their choice, usually Palestine, which was seen as a positive thing by many Germans and Jews. Adolf the Great was the one moderate group which caused much bitterness between the two factions, because it was often perceived that Hitler took little meaningful action against the Jews, while often actively assisting Jews and even harboring Jews as personal friends. The German collaboration with Jewish Zionists, it's called the Havara Agreement, resulted in most German Jews having already left Germany before the war began. An odd agreement seen from today's politically correct perspective, where the deliberate and brutal murder of all Jews is taught and legally enforced in many countries, including Germany, France, Canada, and so forth, on pain of imprisonment or huge fines. Let me see here where we're at. As a result, oh, wait a minute here. This mass movement of people was achieved in a peaceful manner, with many Jews praising Adolf for the manner in which he conducted his delicate procedure. As a result, many Jews fought for Hitler during the war. Jews even nominated Hitler for the Nobel Peace Prize. In short, there was a great deal of support for Hitler from Jewish people until the day he died. Some of this support is documented below. today's almost universal Jewish hatred against Hitler is a syndrome fueled by propaganda after the war and deserves further study elsewhere. The seeds of this later syndrome lies mainly with non-German, typically American Jews who initiated a worldwide campaign against Hitler, and all German Jews that collaborated with Hitler. Documenting Jewish support for Adolf Hitler, common in his lifetime, yet politically incorrect after the war, Jews that supported Adolf the Great. Adolf, with his Jewish friend Emil Maurice in prison, Emil founded the Nazi SS and became an SS member number 2. Adolf was member number 1. Yitzhak Shamir, Israel Prime Minister, former deputy of leader of the NMO, Israel Freedom Movement, that offered to join the war on the Nazi side. Gertrude Stein, Jewish Nobel laureate, novelist, nominated Adolf Hitler for Nobel Peace Prize. Avraham Stern, leader of the NMO, Israel Freedom Movement, that offered to join the war on the Nazi side. Helmut Schmidt, German Chancellor in 1974 to 1982, served as lieutenant in the Nazi Army and Air Force. Documenting Jewish support for Adolf Hitler, common in his lifetime, yet politically incorrect after the war. Quote, Riggs' extensive knowledge and preliminary conclusions drawn from his research impresses me greatly. I firmly believe that his in-depth treatment of the subject of German soldiers of Jewish descent in the Wehrmacht will lead to new perspectives on this portion of the 20th century German military history. That was a quote of Helmut Schmidt, former Chancellor of Germany. Over 150,000 soldiers of Jewish descent served under Adolf Hitler during the war. Some Jews, the NMO from Palestine, offered to join the war and serve on Hitler's side. Hitler's former chauffeur, Emil Maurice, was Jewish, and so was his dietitian, Marlene Exner. Yet after the war, you could no longer find any Jews and almost nobody else who would still speak up for Hitler. The reason is simple. After the war, the Allied propaganda informed the world of Nazi attempted extermination of the Jews, something virtually nobody in Germany knew of during the war. When photos and eyewitness accounts first spread from Camp Dachau, Jews, Germans, and the entire world were horrified. This became known as the Jewish Holocaust and is today the central pillar of accusation against Hitler's Nazi government. The fact is that until the Holocaust became public knowledge, many Jews and most Germans were willing to vote for and fight for Nazi Germany and Adolf Hitler. Counterwise, if the Holocaust extermination program is based on wartime propaganda, as many claim, then Adolf Hitler will someday publicly emerge as one of the greatest leaders in world history. Documenting Jewish support for Adolf Hitler, common in his lifetime, yet politically incorrect after the war. Jews that supported Adolf the Great. Dr. Aleke Fritz Scherwitz, Nazi SS commander in the Eisenstadt Group A2, joined the SS in 1933. Head of the Lente Kaiserwald concentration camp, Commander Ascher served on the battleship Bismarck, awarded Hitler's Deutsch-Putin Kaiserschlump, I can't pronounce it, military award, EK1, EK2, and War Service Cross Second Class. And he was Jewish. Arthur Pisk, standing on left, head of the, there's a picture of this someplace, of the Westerbork concentration camp. All of the OD Westerbork camp officials under Pisk lined up on the right are also Jews. Unfortunately, when I received this article years ago, I didn't receive the pictures. Quote, the ideal German soldier as portrayed by Nazi propaganda was blonde, blue-eyed, said Werner Goldberg. Documenting Jewish support for Hitler, common in his lifetime, yet politically incorrect after the war. division-shaping Jewish society in National Socialist Germany. The standard theory that all Nazis hated all Jews is often accepted as the politically correct thing to believe. Sadly, that belief breeds mischief and can sow seeds of future strife. The more rational truth is that the Nazis had both good and bad in their ranks. Similar Jewish people in Europe had both good and bad in their ranks. The same logic holds true for subdivisions of people, e.g. the German police force or Jewish communists. The path to understanding what really motivated all parties is to study their major divisions, their hopes and aspirations, and see the development of events through the eyes of each group. If events only make sense by criminalizing an entire group, one has missed out on something vitally important. Some groups are more highly motivated than others and likely have different moral standards to others. These should all be weighed against one another in order to understand events. With that in mind, let us take a brief look at the major divisions shaping society in Nazi Germany. Major German Jewish divisions. Jews who have lost their Jewish identity and are totally absorbed into the German society. Jews who view themselves as an independent group and wish to rule themselves in a land of their own. Jews who view themselves as an independent group but have no desire to leave the comforts of their host country. People from amongst the above groups who support a Marxist revolution in Germany. Obviously, there are further complications such as military background, age, and religion, but in the interest of simplicity, we will consider mainly those listed above. Other important factors. The majority of German Jews are Ashkenazi, who on average have a remarkable high verbal IQ. This is a genetic trait which results in those Jews naturally taking up top positions in society, such as medicine, politics, and economics. This causes resentment in the general population, who often suspect vile motives and conspiracies, which is typically not the case except in politics. Jews are unique in world history in not permitting their society to merge significantly with that of host countries. This has protected their culture and genetic lineage for hundreds of years to a large degree. This feature of Jewish society also includes mutual support across borders. Jews are more inclined to support their racial brethren than other cultures, but occasionally also prone to harm one another, perhaps not unusual to any race. Major German non-Jewish divisions. Nationalists in Germany also included Germans living adjacent to, but not part of Germany, who were deprived of their German citizenship after the First World War. National Socialists who want better conditions for the common working class, but without involving foreign powers. Germans who supported a Marxist socialist revolution in Germany. This group is split into those who rabidly object to Jewish participation and or leadership, and those who do not object to a Jewish role in the revolution. These divisions are simplistic, but will do for now. Other important factors. Germans have the highest technical ability on average in the world. This is an inherited trait and is the reason Germany was technically the world leader before the war. Germans were shamelessly abused by the Treaty of Versailles, and general resentment was a national fact. Combined with poverty coupled with international threats and impossible restitution payments, the German public were eager to improve their lot and astounded and impressed by the obvious prosperity wrought by the Nazi government. Adolf Hitler was remarkable in his ability to keep disparate groups of people working together for a common cause. His high intelligence and habit of surrounding himself with others of high ability caused Germany to recover economically and be perceived as a threat by her trading partners, particularly Great Britain. Adolf Hitler was an astute politician. He realized that a democratic victory could only be obtained by being inclusive to as many disparate factions as possible. In this, he was deliberately vague, as in won't with politicians in every Western democracy. Adolf targeted Jewish communists as the enemy, but knew that the finer nuances would not be comprehensible to the average public. So his simplistic message was, quote, blame the Jews and blame the communists, which is usually the same thing, unquote. This is a simple propaganda message which was popular with the electorate and got him elected. Such duplicity is common in politics. When Adolf gained power, he simply failed to implement certain policies he had previously hinted at, although still often giving them lip service. For example, he had previously stated as an absolute principle that certain private property would be nationalized or confiscated, a sop to attract communist voters. Once in power, Hitler did no such thing, and after some time, this caused unrest in the ranks. Some top National Socialists had first converted from being staunch Jew haters and communist agitators to National Socialists, such as Julius Streicher and Ernst Röhm. Hitler was treating Jews far too lightly to their minds, and they saw this as tantamount to treason. A plot to get rid of Hitler was hatched, and the infamous Night of the Long Knives followed after the plot was discovered. Adolf Hitler was not an untouchable dictator. He constantly had to intervene and compromise with his supporters and antagonists, often unable to swing things his way, but on average succeeding well enough for his purposes. The new German government quickly had trouble with anti-Semites in their own ranks. The international Jewish community declared economic war on Germany, and near-bankrupt country was in a state of shock as foreign reserves quickly dwindled to zero. Of course, the Jews were publicly blamed, quite correctly, for this state of affairs, though the majority of German Jews certainly had nothing to do with this. But many rabid anti-Semites, or anti-Jews, among Hitler's supporters demanded action, and clearly something had to be done. Adolf's method of dealing with his anti-Jew supporters over the Jewish problem was typically innovative, although misunderstood by many. He tried to find a formula which would solve the problem, cause minimum disruption, and maximum long-term benefit to Germany. The chief supporters of the Jewish war against Germany were mostly German communists who were mainly Jewish. Adolf had them rounded up and imprisoned in concentration camps. Then Adolf Hitler tried to find common ground with moderate Jews in Germany and found the Zionists were eager to work together with him. The partnership held firm until the end of the war in 1945. In this practice, this meant that German Jewry had to be partitioned into sections. Germans with one or more Jewish grandparents were classed as Jewish. Other Germans are not Jewish. On request or by decree, some Jews could be reclassified regardless of their Jewish ancestry. This happened to an astonishing degree, with Adolf Hitler himself signing a good many such reclassifications. Jews who wished to immigrate to Palestine or elsewhere were treated well, discriminated against in a few respects, and lavishly assisted in other respects. All Jews lost their German citizenship and were in certain categories limited as their profession, but were permitted to have their own schools, living areas, which were financially assisted by the German government. Those who immigrated were given lavish assistance to the extent that a chorus of complaints sounded from within the National Socialist hierarchy. The overall situation was such that although many Jews immigrated, large numbers of them later decided to return to Germany as, despite the limitations imposed on Jews by German government, life was considerably better in Adolf Hitler's great revitalized Germany than in the financial depression which still ravaged the rest of the world. Most Jewish businesses in Germany continued to thrive without interference, even right through the war years. Jews locked in concentration camps formed a minority there, as they were mainly the communist and the criminal elements in the Jewish community. The bulk of the prisoners were German criminals, homosexuals, and others. The Gestapo and the SS developed excellent relations with Zionist groups in Germany and Palestine. Soon an agreement was signed whereby the approved Zionist representatives could visit any German concentration camp and recruit Jewish members for immigration to Palestine. The Zionist representative have total authority to select any or all Jewish inmates that were willing, and the Nazi government would assist financially. Zionists wanted Jews to immigrate, and the Nazis wanted Jews to leave. It was a match made in heaven. The overwhelming support by Zionists also severely disrupted the international Jewish economic war against Germany. Things were doing well. If some non-Zionist Jews grumbled and complained, well, that was just too bad. These were difficult times for everyone. The Jewish problem was resolved itself, and Germany was rapidly emptying of undesired Jews. The process was peaceful, and the economy improved for everyone in Germany. Because of this amazingly peaceful revolution, Adolf Hitler was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by a group of Jews headed by Gertrude Stein. It was too good to last. The international Jewish community was livid and took steps to halt all Jewish immigration from Germany. In this, they were agonizing successfully. Protests by Jewish organizations in Germany against the international Jewish war fell on deaf ears. Documenting Jewish support for Adolf Hitler, common in his lifetime, yet politically incorrect after the war. Jewish leader George Karski, quote, "The Nuremberg Laws also fulfill old Zionist demands," unquote. Karski fully approved of these sections of the Nazi law, which described and enforced the racial separation of Jews and Germans. These, he claimed, legally expressed the long-held desire of Jews to develop their own national direction. The same racial laws are still used by Israel even today to determine the Jewishness of a prospective immigrant. Zionist Jew George Karski repeatedly urged the Nazi government to introduce a Jewish Star of David to be worn by Jews. Eventually, his suggestion was accepted, and on October 1939, it was ordered by the Chief of the Defense, Canaris, that this measure should be introduced into the general government, and on September 15, 1941, it was ordered for the entire Reich. Documenting Jewish support for Adolf Hitler, common in his lifetime, yet politically incorrect after the war, Jews that supported Adolf Hitler. General Johannes Zukertort, a Jew that received medals from Hitler. General Helmut Wilberg received military awards from Hitler. Colonel Walter H. Hollander, decorated with the Ritterkreuz and the German Cross in gold, he received Hitler's awards. Horst Geithner, awarded the Iron Cross Second Class and Silver Wound Badge of his heroic bravery in the service of the Wehrmacht. Admiral Bernhard Rogge received Hitler's military medals, several of them that I can't pronounce. Documenting Jewish support for Adolf Hitler, common in his lifetime, yet politically incorrect after the war. Homepage of Adolf Hitler, also known as Adolf the Great or Hitler the Great. This Adolf Hitler site documents why millions loved their leader, Adolf the Great. The Adolf Hitler website is dedicated to documenting of the life of Adolf the Great and his role in Germany and the National Socialist Party called Nazis by the Allies. Details are not intended to be exhaustive, but present a clear, simple portrait of this mostly unjustly vilified great man. Adolf Hitler, therefore, the material presented may be interesting background material for a school project on Adolf Hitler or on the Second World War, details of the Jewish Holocaust or on the atrocities committed by various belligerents during World War II are not rigorously covered, but links are provided for those who may be interested in these aspects of the war. And that's the end. I'm sure there's a lot more somewhere, but I don't have it in my files. It's quite interesting because I know my suspicions began to be aroused when I was able to dig out that the Zionists and the National Socialists had made an agreement on the handling of the Jews, and they struck a medal for it, which had a Star of David on one side and a swastika on the other. And since that discovery, I have seen a picture, at least a picture, of that medal, which began to make me think there's far more behind this so-called treatment of the Jews and all that kind of stuff than meets the eye. Of course, the problem is that nobody in power on any side wants to admit what probably actually happened. England doesn't want to admit it. I'm sure none of the other countries, France and so forth, want to admit it because they've got a convenient, probably a convenient fall guy in Hitler, and they're going to ride with it. And they don't want anybody interfering with it, like your people who are trying to dig out the true history of what went on, and like the guys at the Institute for Historical Review. But the problem is, anytime the people at Institute for Historical Review or people who work along those lines come up with something, the Jews and their buddies, non-Jews, Christians, and so forth, come back with a $100 million movie to totally obscure the facts of what these researchers find. But there's no way they're going to keep this secret forever. There's no way they're going to keep the truth away from the people forever. But it looks like the truth is going to come out at the hands of the Muslims and people of the dark races rather than from white Europeans and white Americans who've been cowardly in bringing this stuff out. I would say it would take another 20 years, maybe 50 years, for the entire story to be told, but it will be told. It's being told now, but it's just obscured and suppressed, and people just, they've been brainwashed so long about what went on during that period that they won't even listen to anybody talking about it. Well, here's something I've dug out of my archives. I got so much, it's unbelievable. But this was about Fraser Glenn Miller. And amazingly, after his treachery for decades and decades, there were still people out there, including VNN, who were still supporting this guy. The evidence is all in what a rat he was. And he, not only a rat, but he was a psychopath. Ended up in killing people and thinking they were Jews and killing non-Jews. And that blows back on all the rest of us. Here's one, a letter I received. I'm not sure the date on this. Tom, it's been a while since I've emailed you. I first met you at the Arianfest in 1989, and then again at Hammerfest in Georgia. Spoke to you a few times on the phone and an email between those two times as well. Anyway, I remember telling you about Glenn Miller while he was in witness protection, as him and his family happened to be in my hometown of Marionville, Missouri. It's a very small town, about 2,500 people. I got along really well with his son, Jesse, who was interested in becoming a skinhead. Jesse broke out all this stuff about his dad. I was pretty shocked seeing this stuff, since I knew the guy that he was showing me. Anyway, this was back in the mid-90s, probably. Check it out. I got a call from my mother today telling me that Jesse and his mother, Glenn's wife, was involved in a wreck. And Jesse lost his marbles and shot and killed some dude on an old folks bus. Then proceeded to shoot a cop, only wounded him. The cop ended up shooting and killing Jesse. Glenn's youngest son died in a car wreck in the late 80s. And Jesse was his middle son. Glenn's oldest son lives in Missouri and is a homosexual, literally. It has nothing to do with his father, of course. This all just happened today, so the local papers, news, are just getting the info. Here are some links, though. Anyway, thought you might be interested in a bit of information. Hope all is well with you. Now, this information was provided to me by David Tate, order member and prisoner of war, on March the 1st, 2006, entitled "Glenn Miller is at it again." On Super Bowl evening, White Patriot Glenn Miller was featured on Kansas City News, Channel 9, KMBC. The question, however, is whether Miller is really at it again or whether those are directing him are. For those who are unaware, Glenn Miller was once the head of the White Patriot Party in the early 80s. When federal pressures came to bear on him and his followers, he crossed the line and went underground with two of his lieutenants, Robert Jackson and Douglas Sheets. While underground, he penned a declaration of war against the Zionist occupational government. Was arrested within days and captured with automatic weapons in his possession. Later, he conspired with Zog and, under Zog's direction, testified against white movement leaders at the Fort Smith sedition trial in 1987. After serving a couple of years in a minimum security federal prison, Miller spent the next 15 or so years under witness protection program. Miller is a betrayer of the worst kind. During the Super Bowl, Channel 9 had intermittent ads with Miller saying that his definition of a white man is a white man who fights. Any sincere white working man or woman might have been impressed with some of his statements, that is, if they didn't know the truth. As the interview began, the words Aryan Nations were flashed on the screen along with the Aryan Nation symbol. The listener was reminded that an Aryan Nations leader was run out of Kansas City because the city council and the news media had stood up to him, which was untrue, but something that has been rehashed ever since. The reporter insinuating that Miller was connected with Aryan Nations and people should be aware of his racist threat. Something viewers were not told, however, was that one of the defendants at the Fort Smith sedition trial, who Miller testified against, was Richard Butler, the founder of Aryan Nations. Miller then made a few racial statements, and the reporter followed him to build up his image. Miller boasted he was a Vietnam vet, was a good family man, having raised five kids, and so on and so on. Of course, Miller failed to mention that he has two half-breed Oriental children from an earlier marriage. This entire interview reeks of a stink of a setup. Most conspicuous was the report, what it did not say. When the media is interested in a genuine smear campaign, no speck of dirt is spared. So why wasn't Miller's criminal history and prison time exposed? And why no mention of his past declaration of war against his boasts of pro-American patriotism? We know why Miller didn't bring it up, but why did the media ignore it? In my long history of movement involvement, I have witnessed betrayers of all stripes, talk show puppets, people who are not really racist or involved in any pro-white movement, who played the part of rabid racists, who would then have a change of heart and repent their evil beliefs in front of the cameras. I have seen weak men like Floyd Cochran, who claimed to have been propaganda director of Aryan Nations, who turned over a new leaf and got a job touring the country on the ADL speaking tour and being paid well. The traitor in room 14, Tom Martinez, who has shared the podium with Cochran, and even undercover reporters like Peter Lake, the Snake, who was hired by Larry Flint to do an expose on Aryan Nations war, and other later to testify as an expert on numerous trials. Believe me, I have the experience and I know when something is amiss. And so I must warn white men and women of any pro-white political and religious viewpoint. The question is not if, but when Glenn Miller will betray our people. Throughout the interview, Miller held his hand the web address of an organization I'm not familiar with. It was purported to be Miller's website, which means it's a website of the Zionist occupational government. This was another tell. The media rarely slips and allows legitimate racialists to post their websites during interviews, especially not for the entire interview. The hypocrite said, quote, I don't know if I should hate all of you bleep Jews and or just Zionists, unquote. For those who did not know Miller for the snake he is, this whole show might have come off as somewhat positive. But for those who know that Miller had worked hand-in-hand with Zog for almost 20 years, not just including coach betrayals on the witness stands, but payment for hands-on babysitting in the witness protection program. With Zog for almost 20 years, Miller is known as one who will betray again. Miller said, I don't know if I should hate all you. Well, that's the end of that. Now remember, all this information has been available for years to the VNN and Duke's website and all that kind of stuff. So it's been around, but they've ignored it and denied it and attacked people who exposed it. Continuing right on with rats of old and new, quote, the deepest hole in hell is reserved for those who betray a friend, unquote. That's from Dante's Inferno. In no time has Glenn Miller helped any of my co-defendants nor me since he became a government witness, agent, informant, otherwise known as a rat. Let it be known that from my and other perspectives, quote, birds of a feather flock together, unquote. And anyone associating with, promoting, allowing known informants into their organization in any capacity, in any form whatsoever, must also be considered a government rat to be banished and ostracized from the honorable of our race. A rat is a rat. A friend of a rat is a rat. Only a fool would allow a known rat amongst their ranks in lieu of past white separatist history, when our people have been victims of COINTELPRO-type operations such as Ruby Ridge and many more. This goes for any rat out there amongst our ranks and those that associate with the same, unquote. And that was from Randy Evans, POW. Order member. Quote, we are in a real struggle. People's lives are at stake. This is not some game where we can pick up the pieces and go home. This is not television where we can just turn off the dummy box and forget about the show. David Lane will die in prison because of Fraser Glenn Miller. How long will we stand by and let the James Ellisons, the Bill Riccios, the Fraser Glenn Millers pay at being men, play at being men? These government agents talk a mean fight, but when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, they are quick to betray good men and women, condemning them to languish in Zog's gulags with their testimony. We don't need more martyrs. I urge you not to give money or support to Fraser Glenn Miller. Don't support leaders who openly embrace the federal stooge. As far as I'm concerned, Miller can hang out with George Birdie, a.k.a. George Eric Hawthorne, Thomas Martinez, Greg Withrow, William Soderquist, Denver Parmenter, Robert Murky, Bill Riccio, James Ellison, and their ilk. All of them played at being real men and proved they were not up to the task. No longer should they have a voice in anything to do with our people. They should be considered as outlaws of old and forever banished from our community. And that was signed by order member POW Richard Kemp. These are all guys who know where the skeletons are in the right wing. And believe me, there's plenty of them. Let the epithet of race traitor become the most shunned title one can acquire. May it be as dreaded by our people as the bite of a rattlesnake. Let it be shouted in our enemies' faces, painted on their buildings, inscribed on their tombstones, and to those who earn this title, may it become more deadly than the bites of three rattlesnakes. Signed, Louis Beam, longtime fighter. quote, remember, if you're ever working for anything, if you ever stood for anything, if you stand for it with all your life, they can take away from you every material possession, but there's one thing they can't take from you, and that's your honor. The only thing you can do with your honor is to forfeit it. You may have your honor from the day you're born till the day you die, unless you forfeit it yourself. Therefore, my honor is my loyalty. And that was signed by Pastor Richard Butler of Aryan Nations. Here's another statement by a POW. Jesse Lee Baker, 25, an independent skidhead out of Eugene, Oregon, was detained at his P.O. box, his P.O.'s office, in February 2005 for a violation warrant. The FBI then walked in to take the cuffs off if he cooperated. He started talking when he was told the alleged civil rights case and obstruction of justice would carry him 35 years in prison. He then became a full informant and wore a wire to help the FBI in its investigation on skinheads. Two girls were a part of the skinheads in the assault on the temple, October 2002. By this time, had already been interrogated and debriefed for possible indictments against Jacob Lasky, Gabriel Lasky, Jesse Baker, and Gerald Poundstone. But the FBI was looking for a fifth so-called co-conspirator. The FBI then used a paid informant, prior ex-con in his 40s, named Andrew Hengel, who contacted Volksfront and Tualatin Valley skinheads via email. The Eugene skins were tied to VF and TVS, who were called by TVS to meet Hengel. Hengel claimed prior affiliation with militias and was trying to be part of the National Socialist Movement. Andrew Hengel was a weird man who had stupid ideas and only hung out to help in flyer distributions, car repair, or barbecues he held at his house. I ran Hengel's record at the courthouse and saw that not only was he convicted of conspiracy to murder, but was also not to be around children under 18. Hengel had sex abuse and sodomy of minors. A few skins who came around were 17 to 16, and Hengel had tried to have a relationship with a woman who had six children prior to 17, from 17 to 6. Upon receiving the discovery in the case, Hengel was wired, but allowed to break court order to be near minors due to being under federal control. You see, they don't care. They don't care how many people they put in danger as long as they get done what they want done. It gets even weirder. Gerald Anthony Poundstone, 28, was the Volksfront Oregon State Representative and a co-conspirator on the temple attack. The September 6, 2006 Register Guard stated that his plea deal was sealed for his own safety. Why? Poundstone was released at pretrial. Poundstone failed a urine test in March 2006, testing positive for marijuana use, and was arrested, revoked, and pled guilty on April 2006 with an agreement to testify against the Lasky brothers and also Jeremy Baker, the alleged fifth co-conspirator. Before documents were sealed, it was found that Poundstone, while VF state representative, started in late 2003, was himself slowly and methodically working for the FBI as a snitch. He was giving information to the feds, though never wearing a wire, as Baker and Hengel and Poundstone started to work for the FBI after a visit by the FBI in his state PO's office, as they did with Jesse Baker in February 2005. Volksfront pulled Poundstone's patch late in 2005 after federal indictments over the case proved he was an informant since 2003 while involved with the VF. He had given up quite a bit of information and helped the system catch an Orange County skinhead from insane white boys who was on the run, but has now been captured and is doing 20 years in Soledad. The IWB skin is Don Schneider, a.k.a. Crazy, or as the Eugene skins nicknamed him, Tiny, for being 6 foot tall and 300 pounds. Gerald Poundstone himself was a prior IWB skinhead in his early years in Sacramento, California, and was nicknamed Joker. Upon moving to Oregon, he became part of the Volks Front in 2000, part of the FBI snitching program in 2003. Poundstone sent letters to me asking me not to tell anyone that he himself, Poundstone, is a rat so he could stay a skinhead. Both my brother and I cut ties quick and we faced the trial that could carry 30 years. I pleaded to 121-51 with the condition only of acceptance of responsibility, meaning no cooperation. Poundstone received 15 months on September 5th for his work in cooperation snitching. I am the co-founder of Resist, the Northwest Imperative National Socialist Cell Group of Skinheads, pro-Eurofolk, pro-unity, all about family accountability with God, race, nation as its motto. I was Resist prior Northwest director, but due to the incarceration, gave up that position. Anyhow, it goes on and on. Rats and informants, agent provocateurs are rampant in the right wing. And if you're near any of these organized groups, you've got a snitch right by your side. Sorry to say that, but that's just the way it is. And the main place where people make contact are with these chat boards like VNN and Stormfront and all that. That's how the federal agents make their contacts and get next to people and hopefully can talk them into something stupid that won't change anything for us. But it's not going to change because there's always a sap out there someplace that's going to fall for their crap. And leaders who are raking in the money and who are not going to give up their, what would you call that, their little pocketbook, they're not going to give up the incoming money from these outfits like Stormfront and VNN. Anyhow, that's just a little information. I've got a lot more in the vault, in the archives. It's interesting how these rats over the years have been able to call other people what they are. And the minute you call one of them out that you know is a rat, expect a barrage of crap coming back at you. I've had that for years. Anytime I'd expose something rotten in the right wing, there'd be a host of these people condemning me all over the place. Incidentally, none of those people ever supported the POWs or sent them money or anything. And the top leaders literally hated Robert Matthews of the Order. Well, I uncovered some legislation that was passed here in Indiana back in the early 1800s you might be interested in. You may have read it someplace, but I'm going to read it for you again. An act concerning free Negroes and mulatto servants and slaves. Indiana passed several laws intended to restrict the migration of African Americans or Negroes into the state. Though one historian has noted such laws were somewhat symbolic, they provide ample evidence that the vast majority of Hoosiers in the state of Indiana had no wish to share their state with blacks. Section 1, being enacted by the General Assembly of the State of Indiana, that from and after the first day of September next, no black or mulatto person coming or brought into the state shall be permitted to reside therein unless bond with good and sufficient security be given on behalf of such a person of color, to be approved by the overseers of the poor of some township in this state, payable to the State of Indiana, in the penal sum of $500, conditioned that such person shall not at any time become a charge to said county in which said bond shall be given, nor to any other county in this state. Let's see here. And a conviction of such Negro or mulatto of any crime or misdemeanor against the penal stealth laws of this state shall amount to forfeiture of the condition of such bond, provided that on any suit brought upon such bond by the penalty thereof, a less sum than the penalty may, at the discretion of the jury trying such action, be assessed against any defendants by way of damages. Section 2. If any Negro or mulatto coming into this state as aforesaid shall fail to comply with the provisions of the first section of this act, it shall be, and is there hereby made the duty of the overseers of the poor, if any township where such Negro or mulatto may be found, to summon him to appear before some justices of the peace, to show cause why he or she or they shall not comply with the provisions of the act, which summons shall be issued by a justice of the peace on the application of any overseer of the poor in this state, and shall be executed by the proper constable. And if such Negro or mulatto shall fail to give the bond and security required by the first section of this act, after being brought before such justice as aforesaid, it shall be the duty of the overseers of the poor of such township to hire such Negro and mulatto for 6 months for the best price that can be had. In other words, make them slaves and work it off. The proceeds arising from such hiring shall be paid to the county treasurer of the proper county for the use of such Negro or mulatto in such manner as will be directed by the overseers of the poor aforesaid, provided, however, that it shall be lawful for the overseers of the poor to remove such Negro or mulatto without the jurisdiction of the state in the same manner under the same rules and regulations as are pointed out in the act. Anyhow, this is a long and repetitive law, but you get the idea that only on certain occasions could they bring a mulatto or a Negro into the state of Indiana. And they had to have a $500 bond. And if they messed that bond up, then they were hired out as virtual slaves to pay off the bond. Here's a little more of that. Section 1. No Negro or mulatto shall come into or settle in the state after the adoption of this Constitution. Section 2. All contracts made with any Negro or mulatto coming into the state contrary to the provisions of the foregoing section shall be void, and any person who shall employ such Negro or mulatto or otherwise encourage him to remain in the state shall be fined in any sum not less than $10 nor more than $500. Of course, during the Civil War, the governor of Indiana was pro-Southern. And as I recall, they tried to kick him out, and they surrounded the state capitol with federal troops. I don't remember the exact details, but Indiana has been known as being quite racist for a long, long time, and it still is to a degree, but unfortunately they hide behind in-the-closet type situations, you know, where they give all kinds of excuses why they may not like blacks, but their excuses, they don't just come out and say, we don't want blacks around. You see, they're hypocrites. But there is a strain of racism in the state. There's no doubt about that. And many of the politicians in the rest of the country recognize that fact. Well, I leave you up to you the interpretation of this article. Judging from countless array of films, books, and love songs, Stevie Wonder's Ribbon in the Sky, Anthony Davis' Forevermore, and even Beyoncé's Single Ladies, there's always been a fascination with love and marriage. The process of finding that special someone, declaring your love, and navigating life as a couple is a dream of many, if not all, men and women. However, recent news stories set tongues fluttering, and the Negro social media sites into overdrive. According to Newsweek article, Sex, Race, and Education, and the marriage gap, black women are more likely to remain unmarried in comparison to their equally educated white peers. Plus, those with college degrees who do marry usually select spouses from a lower economic tier. In other words, black women are usually marrying down. Only 49% of the black women marry equally educated spouses versus 84% of white women doing the same thing. Many bloggers, myself included, traded theories and speculation about the results, what they translated to for today and the future, by Audrey Chapman, relationship expert, author, and family therapist, interprets these findings differently. Quote, if you check the latest census numbers, more of us are marrying out, Chapman said by phone, referring to 170,000 black women with white spouses in 2006 versus 95,000 in 2000. Remember what I told you about the mulattoes? In addition to counseling couples and families, the Washington, D.C.-based Chapman has written a number of books, including entitled To Good Loving, Black Men and Women in the Battle for Love and Power. Quote, there is also simply not a surplus of available black men, she added. Even if 100 of them stood up as we were talking and said they wanted to marry, still that wouldn't be enough. Half are gay, and 25% want non-white wives. That's Chapman also pointed out that the overall marriage rate decreased in the 60s thanks to the popularity of divorce and women's liberation movement. Quote, with us striving for better jobs and higher education, black men were starting to lag behind, she said. Not that they weren't getting degrees, it wasn't happening at the same rate. Today, if a black woman wants to marry a black man of equal status, those factors still create a problem. Most men don't handle it well when wives out-earn them, and neither do women, quite frankly. Chapman also points to racism, educational discrepancies, incarceration rates, and seismic shifts in the popular culture, including the hip-hop movement and its devolution from rhymes to empowerment to insults that degrade relationships. She also believes that the society's wider acceptance of a single motherhood doesn't help. At one point in the black community, out-of-wedlock pregnancy was something to be ashamed of, she said. Today, women have started making it too easy. If you can sleep with someone, have their baby, and remain in a relationship with them, some men see no reason to get married. However, aside from the conditions that have generated the status quo, Chapman believes that some of the solutions start at home. Quote, women can only raise up men to a certain point, so in the black community need to step up to the plate, she said. If there's not a father available in the home, then there should be one within the family system, like an uncle, grandfather, brother, or even someone in the church. There needs to be more male examples for boys especially to learn from. In the old days, you had the menfolk who were around as ministers or part of the community to help raise the children. So we need to get back to the old ways and incorporate those. End of article. Well, I don't think you're going to go back to those days. And of course, but my point of reading this is about the race mixing popularity of black men is to, you know, usually they want to marry someone who's non-black, but even with them, they don't want to stick with them. And that's why you see white women leading around with a lot of kinky-haired mulatto kids in the grocery stores and so forth. Almost never a black man with them. Yeah. One book I read about black women and black men and so forth that said it's getting so black women the only time they can meet a man is go to a funeral. Jeez. Yeah, man. Well, one good thing about so-called neo-Nazi rallies is that recently in Toledo, the Toledo government had to cough up $80,000. $80,000 in overtime and new equipment costs to police the recent neo-Nazi rally downtown. That's one way to bleed them, boys. That's one way to bleed them. Well, this correct speech is getting to be something over in Britain. Conservative Party candidate in next week's UK local election has been suspended by the party for calling Labour leader Ed Miliband the Jew. But of course, it's the truth. He is the Jew, so you can't tell the truth anymore about anything. if it offends somebody. Of course, I admit I wouldn't want to be called a Jew either. Well, I see the Mayweather vs. Pacquiao fight is coming up on Saturday. That's going to be interesting. Mayweather is the wife beater. He likes to beat up women. And I'm not much into boxing when there's no white guys boxing, but and I certainly wouldn't pay the price to see this fight. But if I was putting money on it, I'd go with Pacquiao. The Central American, I forget which country he's from. Or maybe he's from, I don't know where he's from. He's a non-white, but Mayweather's just a rotten street punk nigger as far as I'm concerned. Oh yeah, to watch that fight on TV, on DirecTV, $99.95. I wouldn't pay $99.95 to see Gorgeous George all over again. I think Pacquiao's going to take him in about the fifth round. What do you think? I'll have to check with my Jew bookie.